Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Swift action needed to curb migrant deaths in Mediterranean. International and humanitarian agencies are calling for swift action to prevent the deaths of migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea from North Africa to Europe. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
This latest disaster occurred late Saturday when a boat crammed with up to 700 migrants capsized near Libya. Only a few dozen survivors have been rescued. International Organization for Migration spokesman Joel Millman tells VOA search and rescue missions are continuing.
The waters are calm and the weather is fair right now. The authorities believe that there remains a chance to find people.
The International Organization for Migration reports the death toll this year is more than 1,500, compared with 96 during the first 4 months of 2014. The majority of migrants making this perilous journey are from sub-Saharan Africa, Eritrea, Somalia, and Syria. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. government agents have arrested six Minnesota men for allegedly planning to travel to Syria to join the Islamic State militant group. The six men, all members of Minnesota's Somali American community, have been charged with conspiracy and attempting to provide material support to a designated terrorist organization. U.S. Attorney Andrew Luger says the men work for 10 months to leave the United States and then join Islamic State. Militant group al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for an apparent suicide attack on a United Nations bus in northern Somalia that killed at least seven people. This is VOA News. The attacker Monday targeted a minibus carrying staffers of the UN Children's Fund in the town of Garoway as they traveled from the guest houses to their office. A source close to the UN in Garoway tells VOA that a man raced onto the bus and then detonated explosives strapped to his waist. Local police said the dead included four foreigners, two Somalis, and the bomber. A reporter for VOA in Garoway says the foreigners included two Kenyans, a Ugandan, and one Afghan, all of whom work for UNICEF. Says the UN has airlifted the bodies and eight people wounded in the blast to Nairobi. The UN representative to Somalia, Nicholas Kay, called the attack a blatant act of terrorism and a desperate attempt to derail Somalia's path toward peace and stability. U.S. and European negotiators are resuming talks Monday in New York on a controversial transatlantic trade deal. The proposal is supported by both U.S. President Barack Obama and German Chancellor Angela Merkel, leader of Europe's biggest economy. But the prospect of a new deal drew thousands of street protesters in Germany, Austria, Belgium, and Finland over the weekend. The new round of talks set to extend through Friday is the ninth negotiating session since last year. Officials say the U.S.-Europe deal would add $100 billion annually to the economies on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. Ethiopia has confirmed that 30 of its nationals were killed by Islamic State militants in Libya. The confirmation came Monday, a day after the Islamic State group released a graphic video purporting to show Ethiopian Christians being decapitated or shot in the back of the head. An Ethiopian government statement condemned what it called the inhuman mass murder of its citizens. It said Parliament will meet Tuesday to declare a period of national mourning and announce measures the government will take in response to the killing. Despite peace talks, Myanmar's military continues to engage in heavy clashes with ethnic rebels in the country's north and northeastern frontiers. Fighting between the Myanmar army and Kachin rebels broke out Saturday and continued until Monday, according to the Kachin Independence Organization. KIO liaison officer Colonel Zaltong told VOA Burmese that the attack occurred despite the fact that his group had been in touch with Myanmar military and government officials. And Russia said Monday that its security forces killed Alyaskab Kebekov, the so-called emir of an Islamist insurgent group in the rest of North Caucasus region. He was killed Sunday, along with four other insurgents, including two senior members, during a special operation. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
This latest disaster occurred late Saturday when a boat crammed with up to 700 migrants capsized near Libya. Only a few dozen survivors have been rescued.
That's reporter Lisa Schlein describing another migrant boat tragedy in the Mediterranean. Details coming up. Also, a look at what happens to those who do make it to the shores of Italy. 7 people are dead as Al-Shabaab targets a UNICEF bus in Somalia. And President Jacob Zuma postpones South Africa's annual tribute to outstanding South Africans and foreigners. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, international and humanitarian agencies are calling for swift action to prevent the deaths of migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea from North Africa to Europe. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
This latest disaster occurred late Saturday when a boat crammed with up to 900 migrants capsized near Libya. Only a few dozen survivors have been rescued. International Organization for Migration spokesman Joel Millman tells VOA search and rescue missions are continuing.
The waters are calm and the weather is fair right now. The authorities believe that there remains a chance to find people. You know, it's a big sea out there and it's easy not to see people. But generally, if someone's missing, they're drowned. That's been our experience, although there also are cases where some bodies are recovered.
The International Organization for Migration reports the death toll this year is more than 1,500, compared with 96 during the first 4 months of 2014. The majority of migrants making this perilous journey are from sub-Saharan Africa, Eritrea, Somalia, and Syria. European Union ministers are discussing possible solutions in Luxembourg. The International Organization for Migration is asking the European Union to once again back life-saving operations on the scale of the Italian-run Mare Nostrum program. That program rescued thousands of migrants at sea, but was shut down last year on the grounds it encouraged people to risk their lives on smugglers' boats. IOM spokesman Millman says governments must become creative in their search for solutions.
We know places like Agadez and Niger that are full of people on their way to Tripoli. Khartoum is full of people on their way to Tripoli. These are very traditional points along the migrant route, and we believe that organizations could be there with a desk and a computer set up and saying, we are going to start registering people. We are going to start seeing who has family in one of these countries in Europe, who could qualify for a humanitarian visa, who could be resettled on a temporary basis with their family.
Millman acknowledges opening such a channel could provoke a stampede of migrants. But given the choice between temporary legal entry to a country and mass slaughter on the seas, he says a stampede is probably the better choice. The smugglers' trade is flourishing in Libya because it is a failed, lawless state. The United Nations is mediating peace talks in that strife-torn country in an effort to reach a power-sharing agreement among the warring parties that could bring stability and curb human smuggling. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. Italy continues its massive search and rescue operation in the Mediterranean off Libya's coast for the capsized boat that was carrying hundreds of migrants. At the same time, Italy is rescuing Syrian migrants from another vessel off the coast of Sicily. For 10 years, Italy has carried most of the responsibility for rescuing and sheltering thousands of migrants. Many become Italian citizens while others travel to other countries in Europe seeking relatives. Barbara Molinari is a public information officer for the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR. She spoke with me from the windy shores of the island of Lampedusa about the condition of the migrants once they arrive in Italy.
It really varies a lot on how they travel. If they're you know, what kind of boat they're on, if they're on a wooden boat or a rubber dinghy. The rubber dinghies are, of course, the more dangerous ones, and they take in a lot of water. So usually we see, you know, cases of hypothermia if it's winter, and sometimes burns from sitting in the fuel. You know, many people need medical attention when they get here. And this is, you know, even in situations where there hasn't been a shipwreck. So we're expecting that people that have been saved out of the water to be needing medical attention and, of course, psychological support, considering the fact that hundreds died, probably among them were their friends and their relatives.
So then what happens to them after they receive the necessary treatment?
Well, they are transferred to reception facilities. In fact, at the port, they receive immediate care, including health care. They go through the identification procedures with Italian police, and they are then transferred to reception facilities. In case of, you know, asylum seekers, people fleeing from war and persecution, they are transferred to centers where their asylum requests can be processed.
Once they are processed, then do they become citizens, or what happens at that point?
If we're speaking of people that are fleeing from war and persecution and they are found to be in need of protection, they are given documents. They're given refugee status by the Italian government, which entitles them to the same rights as an Italian citizen, although they are not citizen yet. So they have the same rights to work, for example, and to other social welfare.
I understand that some of the migrants do leave and go to other countries in Europe. So how are they received in other countries?
Many of the refugees that arrive tell us that they do want to reach other countries in Europe. And that's because of many factors, including the fact that they have relatives already in other countries, or refugees in other countries that they want to reunite with, and also the fact that there are existing communities of their nationalities in other countries. So they feel that they have a better chance at integration in other places. There is, of course, a European regulation that states that the first country is the country where you need to ask for protection, where you should stay and ask for protection. So oftentimes when they do travel to other countries, they are then returned to their first country.
How are they coping with such an influx of people?
First of all, that's necessary to put this in perspective, because numbers, the sea arrivals this year have been roughly the same as the sea arrivals last year. The numbers are really more or less the same. To date, we have 23,000 people arriving by sea to Italy alone. Now, in fact, we have seen in other situations much larger influxes of people arriving. For example, if we think only about the Syrian situation, the neighboring countries have seen 4 million people enter in order to seek protection. So this is a manageable situation, and it's been ongoing now for over a decade. So not only is it manageable, but it's necessary to plan, to have, you know, an operational plan to prepare to receive migrants and refugees coming by sea.
So there is a plan in place, or is the EU working on a plan?
Well, Italy has a plan, of course, because it has been receiving migrants and refugees for over a decade. They are transferred to reception facilities across the country in all regions, not only the ones that are interested by sea landing. And then, of course, there is a reception system in many countries of the European Union to assist asylum seekers and refugees once they get there.
That was Barbara Molinario, a public information officer for the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR. She spoke with me from Lampedusa, Italy. The militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for a bomb attack on a United Nations bus in northern Somalia that killed at least 7 people. Abdelaziz Billo has details from Mogadishu.
The militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for a bomb attack on a United Nations bus in northern Somalia that killed at least 7 people. The United Nations Children's Fund says 4 of its workers have been killed and another 4 in serious condition after an attack on their vehicle in Garowe in the Puntland region of Somalia. The early morning attack on Monday targeted a minibus ferrying UNICEF employees from their guest house to the local UN compound, normally a 3-minute drive. Authorities in Puntland say at least 7 people lost their lives and 7 others were injured in the attack by the Al-Shabaab militant group. Ahmed Abdullah Samattar is the chief of police for Nugaal region.
And dhimasho waa 7 afar waa ajnabi labana waa Somali.
He says there were 7 deaths in total, 4 of them foreigners, 2 Somalis, and the 7th person is the suicide bomber who is being investigated. He says there were 7 injured, 5 of them Somalis and 2 foreigners. Al-Shabaab has been targeting so-called soft targets in Somalia and beyond after the Somali Army and African Union forces dislodged it from the towns and cities it controlled. The UN envoy to Somalia released a statement expressing his shock at the events in Garowe and said that this is a clear sign of the complete disregard for the lives of people working for Somalia's humanitarian and development needs. Nicholas Kay added UN colleagues are saddened but unified in the face of this tragedy and determined to stand by the people of Somalia. President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud, who is in Jordan, attending a security summit on ending extremism in East Africa, condemned the attack and said, quote, by attacking UNICEF, Al-Shabaab has also attacked Somali children. Despite losing most of its territory, Al-Shabaab remains a potent threat to the Somali government and its partners. The group killed 6 Somali members of parliament last year and launched 2 deadly assaults on the presidential palace. Last month, the group conducted its deadliest assault, killing nearly 150 students at Garissa University College in Kenya. Abdulaziz Bilal for VOA News, Mogadishu.
Thank you, Abdulaziz. U.S. government agents have arrested 6 Minnesota men for allegedly planning to travel to Syria to join the Islamic State militant group. The 6 men, all members of Minnesota's Somali American community, have been charged with conspiracy and attempting to provide material support to a designated terrorist organization. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At 17 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. International and humanitarian agencies call for swift action to prevent the deaths of migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea from North Africa to Europe. And 7 people are dead as Al-Shabaab targets a UNICEF bus in Somalia. And for more news and updates, visit our website at www.voanews.com. For developments, President Jacob Zuma has postponed South Africa's annual tribute to outstanding South Africans and foreigners and canceled a state visit to Indonesia. Mr. Zuma has taken the action to mourn the deaths of as many as 7 victims of xenophobic mobs in the last 2 weeks. The April 27th ceremony was to honor residents who have contributed to the development of South Africa. The ceremony marks the anniversary of the 1994 all-race elections that ended apartheid rule. Political leaders have condemned the riots in Durban and Johannesburg. Police have arrested more than 300 people for allegedly looting and burning shops run by foreigners. Police today report calm on the streets over the last 2 days. The violence is blamed on a speech given last month by Zulu King Goodwill Zwelithini. He said foreigners are behind the country's high crime rate and should go back to their own countries. Zwelithini has since appealed for calm and says the South African Human Rights Commission should investigate the hate speech charges against him. Professor Shadrach Guto teaches at the Institute for Renaissance Studies at the University of South Africa in Pretoria. VOA reporter William Eagle asked him if King Zwelithini had violated any laws against hate speech.
Well, from a constitutional point of view, His Highness the King of the Zulus made a very serious mistake and misjudgment. Our freedom of expression is limited in our constitution to exclude hate speech or speech that may create imminent violence. And I think that the king really trampled on all of those.
Do his comments rise to the level of hate speech? And Is there any action that can be taken against him? Where could that possibly lead?
Well, I think that it has been announced that he will address or meet with other traditional leaders and be able to clarify and try to stop the problem. Action that will be taken, which I don't think will occur, is that the police ought to lay a charge, or people ought to lay a charge against him, the police, and evidence ought to be collected, and he ought to be really prosecuted or asked to apologize and to undertake never to do this again. But it is unlikely that it will be done, because it will spill over. If he was punished, then the people who regard themselves as Zulus and so on will start violence, as we used to see in the last days of apartheid, where the majority of the Zulus are, that is KwaZulu-Natal, there was serious black-on-black violence and so on. So I think it has to be approached carefully. He must be censored and asked to really try to repair the damage.
President Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe has criticized the violence, but he's also the chairman of the African Union and SADC this year, the Southern Africa Development Community. Does he have any power to bring about change or to pressure the South African government to become more active and more vigilant?
He had to speak out. And the other aspect is that he was here about 10 days ago for the first time visiting South Africa after 21 years. And there are a lot of agreements that were signed, economic and so on. And we know that for South Africa, the damage is going to be great, and it will even affect the economy really badly, because we are dealing with a situation where in countries like Nigeria, which is the largest economy on the continent and the largest population of a country in Africa, there are South African companies like, the mobile phone group, MTI, that get most of its capital or profit from Nigeria, not in South Africa, but in Nigeria. We do have in Mozambique already talks of a state-owned enterprise, Sasol dealing with oil, gas, and so on, actually stopping operations and sending some of the South African employees in Mozambique back. And Malawi has given South Africa 1 week in which, to do something, or otherwise they will close down South African retail stores and so on that are operating in Malawi, and it will spread. And we do have places like DRC Congo, which is now being seen to be the country that will actually bring electrification to most of Africa because of hydro power in the River Congo and so on. And South Africa is very active in all those, and many more will begin to affect South Africa's economy. So the poor who are fighting other Africans will even be poorer, and the economy may decline. And that is the danger that we are dealing with at the moment.
That was Professor Shadrack Guto of the University of South Africa in Pretoria. He was speaking to reporter William Eagle. World Health Organization Director General Margaret Chan says the agency was not able to cope with the scale of West Africa's Ebola crisis under the agency's current system of operations. She says the WHO was slow and inefficient in dealing with the crisis and alerting the world to the scope of the epidemic. Chan also says the WHO was ineffective in determining the roles of its global partners. The agency's executive board has proposed reforms that call for a 1,000 strong emergency reserve force, a contingency fund, a strong command structure, and improved international health rules. The Ebola virus disease killed more than 10,500 people in 1 year, most of them living in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. New infections have declined significantly, but some areas of Guinea continue to produce new infections with no known source of contact with the virus. In news elsewhere, Thailand is reporting its largest ever ivory single shipment seizure as the kingdom attempts to demonstrate a commitment to battling the illicit wildlife trade amid impending sanctions. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok.
Thailand on Monday put on display 739 tusks of African elephants. They are from an illicit ivory shipment weighing 4 metric tons that was intercepted on Saturday at the port in Bangkok. Richard Thomas, Global Communications Coordinator in London for Traffic International, the Wildlife Trade Monitoring Network, tells VOA this is a very, very significant seizure.
Moving a shipment of 4 tons halfway around the world is not a trivial undertaking, and movements of this kind are very, very strongly indicative of organized crime.
While this latest seizure in Thailand is the most by weight in the kingdom's history, according to a statement from Thai Customs, it is not the largest ever in the region. Singapore made a 7.2-ton seizure in 2002, and Malaysia authorities intercepted 6 tons of ivory in 2012. Thai authorities say the shipment, which was hidden in sacks of beans, originated in the Democratic Republic of Congo and was destined for Laos, making its likely final destination markets in China. Thailand, the DRC, and Nigeria are the 3 countries most implicated in the global illicit ivory trade. Spokesman Thomas of the Traffic Monitoring Network says Thai authorities should be encouraged to follow up the seizure with a thorough investigation of the smuggling network.
The Thai authorities are certainly to be congratulated on making this very important seizure, but it does underline just how serious the nature of this illegal activity that is going on is.
Thai authorities have become more aggressive in attempts to seize illegal ivory shipments after the global regulator CITES informed the kingdom that all of its wildlife business faces wide-ranging sanctions if it does not curb trade in tusks on its soil by August of this year. Registered ivory from domesticated Thai elephants can be sold legally in Thailand. That loophole is blamed for making it easier for poached African ivory to be laundered through Thailand. Environmentalists say 20,000 of the remaining 500,000 African elephants were killed in 2013, primarily poached for their ivory to meet demand in Asia. China is estimated to be the destination for as much as 70% of the illegal ivory market. For many modern middle-class and upper-class Chinese, ivory objects are believed to bring good luck or a way to display status. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 28 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Lino Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Hey. Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. International and humanitarian agencies call for swift action to prevent the deaths of migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea from North Africa to Europe. Seven people are dead as Al-Shabaab targets a UNICEF bus in Somalia. And President Jacob Zuma postpones South Africa's annual tribute to outstanding South Africans and foreigners. Coming up, we'll have music from Uganda and our feature reports. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, another big day for African athletes at the Boston Marathon.
Kim, the world's oldest annual marathon was run for the 119th time on Monday here in the United States. And African athletes once again celebrated victories in the Boston Marathon. Lalisa Desisa of Ethiopia won the men's title in an unofficial time of 2 hours, 9 minutes, and 17 seconds. Lalisa also won the Boston title in 2013. And Kenya's Caroline Rotich won the women's crown in an unofficial time of 2 hours, 24 minutes, and 55 seconds. Caroline won a thrilling sprint finish against Ethiopia's Mare Dibaba. Talk to us, Caroline!
Yeah, we ran until 25, and I knew I'm not going to drop out 25, so I was like, I'm going to wait until the finish line and see how she can do it, and I did it, so I'm so grateful. I have been waiting for this and training and training, and when we came through 25, like this last race corner, I feel like, yeah, I want to do this, and I could let it go.
Caroline Rotich and Lalisa Desisa each won $150,000 for their Boston Marathon victories. Here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to Ethiopia's Lalisa Desisa and Kenya's Caroline Rotich, the 2015 Boston Marathon men's and women's champions.
Voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Paul Tergat, marathon champion from Kenya. You are listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Now let's go to Stellenbosch in South Africa's Western Cape Province. That's where Marco Uma filed this report on the South Africa Senior Athletics Championships.
Stephen Mokoka stole the limelight when he won the 5,000 meters in a new national record of 13 minutes and 10.89 seconds. Despite qualifying in 5,000 meters for the World Athletics Championships during Beijing, China in August, Mokoka insists he's focused on qualifying for the 10,000 meters at the IAAF Diamond League in Eugene, Oregon State in the United States of America in June.
With Eugene now, it's a matter of trying to qualify because my main aim at the World Championships, I want to run 10,000. I have to go there in a rational pace so that I can be able to try and run the qualifier there because I want to focus on the 10,000 at the World Championships.
There you may not have your teammates to help you with the pace. Do you feel that you'll still be able to do it even though your training partners who helped you out today will not be there?
I mean, at Prefontein, it's all about Nike runners, so those guys are very fast. I think they are going 26 pace, so I will just try to find a proper group for myself so that I can follow them all the way till I go to the finish. So my main aim is just to try to follow them. I mean, with my own pace, I hope I'll be able to cope with that so that I can be able to run the qualifier 27:45.
That was Stephen Mukoka, South Africa's new 5,000-meter record holder, speaking in Stellenbosch. Meanwhile, 10 more athletes attained the qualifiers for the World Championships. They are sprinters Anaso Jobodwana and Wade Fanny Kirk in the men's 200 meters and 400 meters respectively, long jumper Rashwal Samai, shot putters Orazio Cremona and Yako Engelbrecht, together with the men's 20-kilometer race walkers Lebohang Shange and Wayne Sneyman. Louis Van Zyl and Wenda Nell qualified for the men's and women's 400-meter hurdles respectively, while Sunette Fulyun made the cut in the women's javelin. Finally, Chris Haramson achieved a rare milestone, winning his 20th consecutive men's national hammer throw title. The Africa hammer throw record holder is humbled.
I was nervous today. It was funny. I always wanted to have 20. Now it's another barrier. Maybe the next one will be easier. I hope so. The stress will not be that much, but it's always very exciting and it's always nice. I'm always proud to be the best hammer thrower in South Africa, and I try to keep that spirit alive, and it's my responsibility now until the younger guys come up and take it from there. But it feels amazing. It's nice knowing you've got 20 titles in a row. It's very nice.
That was Chris Haramsa, the 20-time South Africa men's hammer throw champion. I'm Mark Omer in Stellenbosch, Western Cape Province in South Africa.
Joining us now with a package of African football news is the VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Shagun Dot on the spot at Ayemi.
Good evening, Africa. It's football to the rescue as xenophobic attacks spread in South Africa, with at least 7 people killed in the past 2 weeks from attacks on mostly African immigrants in South Africa. The country's football authorities have turned to the beautiful game to help douse the fire. They say South Africa's national team will play 2 international friendly matches against neighboring countries in a bid to sensitize the public on the evils of xenophobia. We want to use the 2 high-profile international friendly matches as an instrument to unite this continent. What has been happening in the past few days have really left most people shocked and dismayed, says the chief executive officer of the South African Football Association, Dennis Mumble. SAFA said the details of the 2 matches will be announced soon. Let's now head to Egypt. Death sentences handed down to 11 soccer fans were referred to the country's top religious authority, the Grand Mufti, for approval on Sunday. The 11 were sentenced to death in the retrial of over 70 defendants accused in a soccer riot in 2012 that left 74 dead. In Egypt, referral to the Grand Mufti is a necessary procedure before issuing a death sentence, according to the Egyptian law, though the religious opinion of the Mufti is not binding. The court has set May 30th for the date of the final verdict and placed a gag order on the case. Defendants hold the right to appeal against the verdict. 73 defendants were retried on charges of killing 74 Al Ahly fans after a match with Al Masry Football Club on February 1st, 2012. 9 police officers were tried in the case, but none of them was among the 11 who received the death sentence. In January 2013, a court sentenced 21 Al Masry fans to death while delaying the sentences on 52 others for legal reasons. Al Ahly fans welcomed the sentences, but were angered that none of the 9 police officers tried in the case was convicted. Finally, Ethiopia's Portuguese coach Mariano Barreto will leave his post at the end of this month. That's 1 year before his 2-year contract ends, according to the Ethiopian Football Federation. Barreto, a former Ghana coach and assistant manager of Russian side Dynamo Moscow, signed a 2-year deal in 2014. But the 58-year-old coach failed to guide Ethiopia to this year's Africa Cup of Nations tournament. The team also reached the knockout round of qualifiers for last year's World Cup in Brazil, but lost over two legs to continental heavyweight Nigeria. Grouped alongside Algeria and Seychelles, Ethiopia kicks off its campaign for a place in the 2017 Nations Cup at home to Lesotho in June. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Turning to tennis, world number one Novak Djokovic has won the first big clay court tournament of the season. The Serbian star scored a three-set victory over Tomas Berdych of the Czech Republic to win the Monte Carlo Masters trophy. The final score from Monaco, 7-5, 4-6, and 6-3. Afterwards, Djokovic commented on the keys to his victory.
I thought I won this match with my heart and with battle. That's how I feel like I won it. I don't think I've played on the level that I wish to play and that I have played throughout the whole week. But in the end, I'm sitting here with this trophy that is very special to me, of course, and this is what matters. And sometimes winning ugly is necessary. And it's been a remarkable start of the season for me. And, of course, couldn't ask for a better start of clay court season.
Novak Djokovic talks about his remarkable start to the season. He's now won 17 matches in a row. Hey, Novak, how long can you keep the winning streak going?
I don't know. Honestly, I'm not thinking about how long I can keep it or how long the streak will go. Fortunately, I had this one time similar situation my career in 2011 when I won over 40 matches in a row. And then, you know, I got that question asked basically after every match, you know, how long it's going to go. I really don't know, and it is something that I cannot influence and I cannot predict. I'm healthy, you know, obviously very confident, and everything is going in the right direction. I just need to take some time off, which is equally as important as the work that I do on the court.
Serbian tennis star Novak Djokovic speaking in Monte Carlo, where he won his latest title. From the tennis court, let's go to the basketball court and an update on the NBA playoffs. First round action tipped off over the weekend. Let me quickly give the winners of the opening games in all of these best of seven series. The Los Angeles Clippers, the Memphis Grizzlies, the Atlanta Hawks, the Cleveland Cavaliers, the Houston Rockets, the Chicago Bulls, the Golden State Warriors, and my beloved Washington Wizards. The Wizards were the only team to score a road victory, clipping the wings of the host Toronto Raptors in overtime, 93-86. The other teams all won on their home floor. If you're just tuning in now to the Voice of America, African athletes swept the men's and women's titles on Monday during the 119th running of the Boston Marathon. Lelisa Desisa of Ethiopia won the men's title in 2 hours, 9 minutes, and 17 seconds. And Kenya's Caroline Rotich won the women's crown in 2 hours, 24 minutes, and 55 seconds. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, Sierra Leone reopens schools after the worst Ebola outbreak in history. And fishermen along the Nile near the Jonglei state capital, Bor, want to expand their markets but need something important that they don't have. First, here's Lady Titi of Uganda with It's Okay.
Okay. se wakati mwanganda vye Ibiyo wose ya bitwala Amutima vange kwa kere chimuti okay Kusaba uwele yo Kanyo kubirenga kakusimu Kale naona Naona mikwano na veroke Kanyo kera mutima vange na ya It's okay, it's okay. Hey, yeah, hey. Anya nyaga na mutima kwenye na yeye. Mune nyange vibo kemo. Sifaya, kuma kwange kwa kera chimu na we. It's okay, it's okay. Hey, yeah, hey. Sababu alila nyamu siko mudiro. Mbolinga chalaba minokomu. Nakatacha kube mu maso zinaba binyuma Lugenda wala vulugenda Kusama angasala narutuka Kuli kutu kuli kuulia Mugugalo wange muri kwa tako It's okay, yeah. It's okay Onye nyagera mutima kwenye na ya
Mune nyange biboke mungi
Sifaya Kwa kwange kwa kena chimu na we It's okay, it's okay. Onya nyaga na mutima kwenye na
yeye. Mune nyange biboke mungi.
Sifaya, kuwa kwange kwa kera chimu na we. It's okay, it's okay. Chikumya kwagala kumikiriza mwatu kusirika kasera busera
kusebiro wozo
tula baba galama nola waza tibekosa ino lavu chambalo uliomu wa chambala asinange na yambala kwe muli mutima it's okay it's okay hey, yeah. It's okay, it's okay. Hey, hey. Mutima kwenye na
yeye. Nyange biboke mungu.
Sifaya, kuwa kwange kwa kera chimu na we. It's okay, it's okay. Hey, hey.
It's okay, that's Lady Titi of Uganda. While Sierra Leone has reopened its schools after the worst Ebola outbreak in history, but the government has announced a ban on pregnant girls attending class because it says they set a bad example. Nina DeVries has more on this story from Freetown.
The director of Amnesty International in Sierra Leone, Solomon Sugbandi, is concerned about the government's policy. Sugbandi says not allowing girls into classes is a violation of their human rights.
It is an immoral issue because when you look at the Education Act of 2004, it makes it very, very clear, says that on no account should any child be discriminated against. This is a serious provision which we want government to look at.
The ban on pregnant girls in class is not new. It has been in place since 2010. But Sugbandi says the government should make an exception because of the Ebola crisis and the impact it's had on young women. He says there's been an increase in sexual violence and unwanted teenage pregnancies during Ebola.
But the fact of the matter is the situation is a bit abnormal. It's not of their own making. There have been no effective teaching and learning situation due to the fact that the Ebola disease has, you know, put its halt on all practices as well as every activity that people should undertake.
As schools set to open Tuesday, girls like Aizatu Banke have no choice but to stay back.
I know they feel fine. I feel bad. Guys, now, like, where do you go to school?
The 17-year-old explains in her native Creole dialect that she can't go to school because of her pregnancy and is not happy. She doesn't like the policy and wants to join her friends in class.
You go to school. Now you force me, forgive me, belly.
Aizatu says she was raped by a fellow student. He forced her to have sex while she was fetching water for her family. She's hoping the government will make an exception for girls like her. But Ministry of Education, Science and Technology Public Relations Officer Brima Michael Touré says the government will not change its policy. He says even if they made an exception for pregnant girls, chances are they wouldn't attend. There's a great shame when a girl becomes pregnant in Sierra Leone's culture, he says, and much of the time the family tries to hide it.
They will isolate the child. They wouldn't want the neighbors to know that that child was in the home and she got pregnant while she's still under their care. They will take the child somewhere, to a family member somewhere. The child would, that girl would deliver the child, and then they will send her back to that home, and no one would ever know they had a child.
He also said that with vomiting being an Ebola symptom as well as a common side effect of pregnancy, the girls are better off to be at home. That way, there's no fear of a suspected Ebola case and an increase for panic among students and teachers. Touré adds that the ministry will consider alternative options for pregnant girls if suggestions are made, but at this point, there will be no exceptions. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
While fishing provides a decent income for many living along the River Nile, especially near the jungly state capital, Bor, some fishermen earn an average of $10 per day. They'd like to earn more by selling to other markets, but they can't unless they have refrigerated storage limits. Philip Thon Aliyu reports from Bor.
At this bright fish market in Bor town, a man shouts out the prices of Nile fed and other fish caught hours earlier off the banks of the Nile, west of Bor. A 1.5-meter Nile fed, the biggest fish, sells for 300 South Sudanese pounds, the equivalent to 1 month's wages for a senior level state government worker. Fresh tilapia and lungfish fetch between 40 and 80 pounds. 45-year-old fisherman Jacob Grang heads out to his favorite fishing sites in his 6-meter-long wooden boat. He says this has been the best season he can remember.
I take some fish to my home and sell others. This fishing helped me a lot, only that the level of water have risen. But if it was the other season, I make at least 100 South Sudanese pound or 80 a day.
Grant says he has been fishing since early adulthood. The big fish he displays in the marketplace today are not the largest he has ever caught. The big catches he sells privately or takes them home to his family for dinner. Grant fishes the traditional way by attaching a light object, like an empty plastic container, to float on top of the water attached to the fishing net. Once that object is taken and appears to be drowning, he yokes the fishing net from the rear and slides into the boat.
Once it catches fish, and I'm sure that it is there, I will pull it to the boat, and I can make 3 or more trips a day.
Grant says it is important for him to try and build a lucrative fishing business now, rather than simply providing food for his family alone. Now, he hopes and travel to board from his own home community in touch to sell fish. At the main River Nile fish market, middlemen buy Grang's fish and then others sell it to consumers in Bor. Middleman Kunyuma Nyang can turn around and sell only a few fish in one day.
You will be left with two options. Sell them at the same amount you bought them, or take them home for your family to eat. And that money you use for buying will be a loss. Business does not grow with losses.
Manyang does not have a refrigerator, and by noon, if he still has dozens of unsold fish, he worries they will rot. Some buyers come all the way from Juba to buy fresh fish, but there is a concern that spoiled specimens will ruin the market's reputation. That is why state government officials decided to support local fishermen last January. Jongle State Information Minister Judy Jongle Boyaris says the government now rents out boats at subsidized cost. He says there are even plans to eventually make a batch available for rental.
We will get little because we need to promote the business people in Jungle Estate. So if you want to actually pay something for renting that bike, you are welcome. And the fish are actually in the river.
In the meantime, individual fishermen and middlemen rely on themselves. Cholo Dao takes his boat to Gurthom, a fishing site in Lagos State's Awadia County. He says he loses many fish if his boat breaks down in the middle of the river, and he cannot wait for government help.
The government is overwhelmed by many challenges, and so everyone is trying his best to survive and help his family. The government will get us the survivors on the way.
Dao, like many other fishermen here, needs an efficient means to transport his fish to major markets. Adiu Mahmoud is a regular customer at the Bor main market. She says despite increasing prices, she will buy at least one for his family.
I don't blame the fishermen for the increasing prices because we hear there are problems with the dollar. But I will go back home to get more money because the amount I have here is not enough. I will come back.
Adil says she worries when she gets home, she will find the fish is no longer fresh and will have to return it. But for now, Adil is willing to pay a little money for fresh fish, and the fishermen here hope she keeps coming back. For BOA News, I am Philip Tonaleo in Bor.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Although there has been encouraging news about the Ebola epidemic in West Africa in recent weeks, new infections with the virus continue, and the United States remains committed to doing what it takes to stop them. Last September, President Barack Obama announced a major increase in the U.S. effort to help combat the outbreak, setting an example for many other countries as well. Together, we greatly increased the contributions of our doctors and diplomats, soldiers and supply experts, health workers, humanitarian specialists, and others. All are working side by side to stop the epidemic. Ebola treatment units and basic response infrastructure are now in place. There are more than enough treatment beds for the current number of cases, and the soldiers and engineers who put them in place can now return home. That does not mean the epidemic or the commitment of the United States to end it is over. Experts say the last mile of ending an infectious disease epidemic is often the hardest. Finding every last infected person and their close contacts, no matter how remote, requires painstaking work in remote locations led by experienced epidemiologists. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control is providing many of the needed personnel, and other countries are being encouraged to increase their contributions at this stage of the epidemic as well. Now, a year after the first U.S. personnel were deployed in the region, reported Ebola cases have dropped sharply in Guinea and Sierra Leone, and Liberia, once a hotspot, has no known active cases, according to health experts. But while U.S. troops who provided transport and infrastructure are leaving, the United States is not leaving West Africa behind. In keeping with President Obama's charge that we tackle Ebola as a U.S. national security priority, we will continue to lead the international Ebola response we helped to build. More than 10,000 U.S.-supported civilian responders are on the ground to fight the disease. The next phase demands sustained, targeted involvement as we work to achieve zero cases in West Africa, while building the capacity within the region to prevent, detect, and respond to future outbreaks before they become epidemics. While we have succeeded in controlling the exponential growth of the disease, getting to zero cases will require a sustained and targeted international response. The fight is far from over, and we remain committed to achieving an Ebola-free West Africa.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next on Let's Talk, join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing pets in Africa. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA.